Gregory Chinooshian, Colorado, registration number 12204, appearing on behalf of Susan Levy and Constance Googe Richardson. May it please the court, I would like to address the issue of propriety of offsetting MedPay benefits paid against the ultimate UIM award first, if I could. It is the contention of the appellants that it was improper on both part of judge.
Hold on just a moment. Bailiff, please begin the clock.
Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you. So going back to our position, we believe it was improper on the part of both Judge Schwartz and Judge Gilbert to permit American Family to offset the medical benefits that were paid under the claim against the ultimate arbiter award. Our position is that when the claimants sought permission from American Family to settle the liability claim against tortfeasor and its insurer, it received a letter dated February 17th, 06, wherein permission to settle was granted. And specifically in that February 17th, 06 letter, American Family took the position that it waived any right of subrogation against tortfeasor. The matter proceeded via a lawsuit against American Family seeking the uninsured motorist benefits, and subsequent to the arbiter's award, where there was a specific finding in both cases as to the total of MedPay benefits in Ms. Levy's case, 24, Court of Appeals number 09-2451, it was a set off of $18,898.23 permitted by Judge Gilbert. And in Ms. Richardson's case, 09-CA-2668, there was a $25,000 amount which was permitted to be offset by Judge Schwartz. Our contention is simply by virtue of the fact that American Family did waive that right to recover against tortfeasor, that waiver should also apply to any claim that American Family would have against their insured.
Now, I didn't see a contention, counsel, that she was somehow a third-party beneficiary, or your clients were somehow third-party beneficiaries for these waivers. Is that something that was argued in the trial court?
No, I think it was subsumed with the fact that there was a waiver against tortfeasor. And if they're not going to go after the money from the tortfeasor, we believe it's impermissible under the terms of the contract for them to go turn around and come back and say, well, we want credit against the benefits paid under UIM.
Why is that necessarily the case if they're not third-party beneficiaries?
Because our secondary argument is that in the context of a MedPay UIM scenario, the individual has paid twice for the benefits. First, the MedPay, they paid a separate premium. And then following that, they have paid a separate premium for the UIM.
Well, couldn't an argument be made that she got the benefit of the med payments coverage because she didn't have to wait for reimbursement and she didn't have to hold off paying her medical providers until she recovered from the tortfeasor?
And I recognize that argument that was raised in a recent case, D. Herrera. But that was a separate issue because D. Herrera involved a settlement with a tortfeasor without regard to permission from the insurer. And in D. Herrera, the court did not address the issues of Colorado's tradition against, I think they used the term anti-subrogation. As far as first-party benefits.
Right, but my point is it's not as if she didn't receive any benefit from the med payments coverage. She received a benefit in the sense that there was no delay.
Yes, we recognize that. But in the final outcome, though, the fact that she had paid, and she did pay for and did get that benefit, but then to have that benefit
deducted from her UIM benefits when American Family chose not to pursue the subrogation. There's where we think the unfairness to the claimant arises. That American Family had made a decision to walk away from its right to recover those amounts of money. So, continuing on with our analysis about the impropriety of the offset is that in Colorado law, as we look through the history, and I mentioned in my brief, I believe that there's been a consistent approach in Colorado law to say where an individual has paid for a benefit, there is no propriety in causing the deduction for the benefit that they receive, namely the exception to the collateral source rule. When Colorado law recognized, the legislature said, hey, we're going to make an exception for the common law collateral source rule for those people who seek and choose to pay that for extra insurance benefits, we're not going to take away the right to recover for those particular benefits. That being the exception of 1321.11.1.6. It's just a matter of public policy. The legislature, although it amended the statute for MedPay after this accident occurred, I submit in 10.4.635, where they statutorily stated that MedPay benefits shall not be subrogatable, the legislature simply affirmed what had already been our public policy that had been developed through the case law. So on that basis, it's our position that it was improper to offset those MedPay benefits because it would ultimately reduce the value of the insurance coverage.
So, Commissioner, let me ask you about the party's apparent mutual understanding that the arbitration panel could modify the award to allow the district court to make an addition or reduction related to the medical payments. Is that your understanding, that the language that was used by the arbitration panel specifically granted authority to the trial court to make that adjustment?
If that were the case, then it would logically follow the adjustment for interest and post-arbitration award costs would follow.
And why is that?
Well, in trying to analyze this case, I take the approach that we had a legal action filed alleging claims for benefits under the contract to include not only those damages that can be recovered, such as pain and suffering, emotional distress, medical expenses, as well as permanent impairment. But the pleadings also asked for relief under 1321.101, pre-judgment and post-judgment interest, as well as costs, which would be payable under the rules of Civil Procedure 54. When the American Family asked for arbitration, it was our understanding it was arbitration as to the amount of damages. And unlike the Duncan case, where the arbitration talked about all claims arising from the transaction, we were talking in terms of damages. The American Family specifically asked the arbiters to set out in their damage award the amount incurred for the medical expenses. And they then, American Family, subsequently sought to affirm that award based on those particular findings, and the courts did permit the offset against the UIM.
So let's get back to my original question.
Yes.
Apparently you would agree that there was an exception, a modification to the arbitration award, which specifically allowed the trial court to make an adjustment with respect to medical payments. correct?
Yes.
Okay. And as pertains the prejudgment interest, the contract of insurance requires arbitration for any dispute arising in connection with the policy. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So when the matter was submitted to the arbitration panel, it was submitted for all purposes, all matters in dispute. Right?
Damages. And the arbitration panel's award spoke in terms of damages.
Let me follow up with that just a little bit.
Yes.
With regard to the prejudgment interest, you said that it was pled in the complaint, both a request for prejudgment interest and costs. Who was that complaint made out to? Who was it originally filed with?
In the District Court of El Paso County.
Okay, so then when it got moved to the arbitration proceeding, was there still a request for prejudgment interest and costs?
The pleadings had not been amended in the District Court, and the agreement, as I understood it, was to be for the damages, not all claims. And in fact, the arbitration award specifically said we find for the damages.
Well, isn't prejudgment interest an element of damages?
The Parker case calls it an element of damages for the purposes of inclusion in the uninsured motorist policy limit, as I understand Parker. My approach and analysis, Your Honor, is first we look at Civil Jury Instruction 6.1, which lays out the elements of damages for a bodily injury claim. Monetary, economic damages, medical bills, what have you, pain and suffering, emotional distress, and permanent impairment. That's your element of damages. We then look at 1321.101C, which speaks in terms of pre-judgment and post-judgment interest on awards for damages, and then Rule 56 addressed costs as a matter of right to the prevailing party. So our view is that this arbitration panel is analogous to either a trial to the court or a jury trial, and in neither of those cases do you, as the plaintiff, present your claim for prejudgment interest, post-judgment interest, and costs. The issues presented are damages, and then after damages are determined, the application of 1321.101 comes in as to the amount of costs or prejudgment interest, and then Rule 54 as it relates to costs of proceeding.
So you see no difference between the terminology used by the arbitration panel, gross damages, and the terminology that you've employed today in your argument, damages?
I think they're the same, because they're speaking strictly in terms of damages, not all claims. And I respectfully submit the in a bodily injury case involving UIM coverage, we've got three key elements, or three claims: damages, interest, costs. And it was the damages that were conceded to the arbitration panel for then later determination by the court for prejudgment interest and costs. I will yield or reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You have a little bit less than 7 minutes remaining.
Good afternoon. I'm Anthony Johnson. I guess I should say Johnson Anthony, lawyer, serial number 4990. I have to do all that talking to remember. My number is 4990. The agreement, Judge, came about because of the dispute over the recoverability, again, by the plaintiffs of the medical pay. Mr. Chernishin and I had a disagreement, and we determined that we would reserve that question and not submit it to the arbitrators. And there the first thing I said to him was, we have agreed that once you make a finding as to damages, we'll apply the contract to it. Please put that in your order. And they didn't. And after, I made a request that they amend their order, which they can do for clerical matters. It's not substantive, to add that provision that we had agreed that we would apply the policy. The policy, we didn't tell them, but I was talking about the policy limits and this business on the medical pay. The interest came up later.
So the agreement did not specifically deal with interest as something that would also be reserved?
No. No, sir.
All right.
So we and I think they recognized that their commission in their order was to find all damages. And I thought some of the damages were, some of the medical things were not reasonable and necessary, so I asked him to find damage, medical, itemize the medical bills that were reasonable and necessary, which they also did. And I believe, unless I'm thinking of another case, they subsequently clerically amended their order to include our agreement that we reserved those legal questions of the application of the policy to the award.
Also, so the complaint, then your counterpart says the entire complaint moved over from El Paso District Court to the arbitration panel to be decided. Would you agree with that?
No, sir. I've known Mr. Chanushin for years, and he's not going to try to lie to anybody. But he's like the rest of us, misremembers some things. The complaint was a complaint demanding arbitration. That was the remedy that he sought in his complaint. It was a complaint that he's entitled to arbitration on the UM. And we had a phone discussion, and in fact, we talked about whether we'd do three arbitrators or one arbitrator. We decided on three, and I've got a letter in my file. I think we agreed that the claims would be dismissed once the arbitration got going. But the remedies sought were arbitration. And when we finished the arbitration, those cases were still there. And as you know, you need a district court case to get the arbitration certified or confirmed, whatever. So we just stayed with those. But I think he has forgot that. I never filed an answer to the complaint for arbitration. My firm didn't. I have a letter. One of my associates wrote the letter at the beginning of the case, and then I took it over. So that was our intent. And then when we discussed it, we said we're not going to submit the question of this MedPay to the arbitration panel. Let's just find out what the damages are and go from there. And this is, with respect to that, this is a contract case, of course. And it is a claim under a contract of underinsured motorist coverage. The damages or award or amount due under the contract are established by reference to court law, or to tort law. The plaintiffs were entitled, the claimants were entitled to recover what they were entitled to recover from the tort feasor.
So pardon me for interrupting, counsel, but was there some statement of what the claimed damages were that was presented to the arbiters that would have included prejudgment interest or any in any form?
Our recollections, I believe, differ on that. I don't recall any claim for interest or costs being made in the arbitration.
Is there anything in the record that would show what was claimed in the arbitration?
No, Judge, but I would note that in one of the briefs submitted for one of the claimants, and I don't recall which, Mr. Chernushin recalled making a request for interest. Now, as far as the district court complaint, I'm not sure. I didn't give it to the arbiters, and I don't believe counsel did either. I don't think they ever saw it. And you know, whether it was requested or not in the arbitration, Judge Terry, is if it was requested, then it was refused. If it wasn't requested, there's a case that says you can't complain. So in either event, the interest is not applicable. The accident in this case was a big bang, but the injuries were not terrible. I think one of the claimants was primarily chiropractic and the other was perhaps half chiropractic. And I thought the awards, and my thinking doesn't matter, the awards could be considered rather generous. Now, with respect to the medical pay coverage, the plaintiffs have the appellants, and I go back, this is a contract case, and the damages are established by tort law, and they're established by the arbitrators. So when they say these are all of the damages, that's what they are. Now, are they entitled to recover again the medical pay coverage? And we're urging no, that the judges were right, both of them. The lower court, Judge Schwartz and Judge Gilbert, said that they are not recoverable. And the theory presented to them is, I hope, maybe not, maybe my writing got sloppy, but it is that the policy says that you, if we pay something, we're entitled to all your rights of recovery for what we pay. Now, when an underinsured motorist processes a claim, they're processed as counsel did, and if the tortfeasor is underinsured and it comes time to get whatever insurance he has, they make a request to the insurance carrier, in this case my client. And they say, we want to take, now there were three people that made claim against the tortfeasor's insurance, these two and the gentleman. And we want to take this money and give a release to the tortfeasor. Because insurance companies have to try and get a complete release of their insured before they pay the money, or they're in one of those soups that I'm sure you've seen called bad faith. And so when the insured party says, I want to take this money, and they won't give it to me unless you release your interest. And the insurance carrier then does an asset check on the tortfeasor to see if they're someone with a lot of money carrying a small amount of insurance. And if not, they waive their right of subrogation. Well, they give up their right of subrogation. That doesn't mean they assign it back to the injured party. They give it up to facilitate the settlement. Now that, collateral source rule prevents the tortfeasor from taking advantage of collateral sources. There is no application in this case. The anti-subrogation, I mean, everybody knows that. You can't subrogate against your insured. That's not what happened in this case. The purpose of underinsured motorist coverage and uninsured motorist coverage is to attempt to place the injured party in the same place they would have been had the tortfeasor been solvent and had enough to pay them, had the wherewithal to pay them. And in this case, that occurred. Now, there are other rules that would have prevented such a deduction had the damages awarded not placed the plaintiffs, the appellants, in that situation.
Mr. Johnson, excuse me for interrupting, but you've touched on a point that Mr. Chernushin argues in his brief, where he says that, and the point is that here there's a third-party tortfeasor from whom the injured insured can collect. But Mr. Chernushin cites to Barnett, and Barnett cites in turn to a federal district court case, Newton versus Nationwide, for the proposition that it undermines the rationale of UIM coverage to allow an insurance carrier to offset other payments against its UIM coverage. Would you care to comment about that?
Yes, Judge. I think I was around when Nationwide was decided, but those were cases where the insured was actually damaged by the insurance companies. In other words, it reduced the amount of coverage available to the insured by the subrogation against the tortfeasor. And they have no application here because the amount of insurance available was more than enough to pay what the appellants were entitled to. And I did the math in my brief. And my explanation is, our explanation is, that the plaintiff, the appellants, had no right to recover that medical pay from the tortfeasor. And when American Family waived their right, now you want to remember, American Family didn't get a penny out of that. They paid for one $25,000 in medical pay. For another one, they paid $18,000 in medical pay. They got none of that back. This is not a subrogation where they went against the tortfeasor and got their money back. So there is no benefit to them and no damage to the injured parties. They received everything they would have got had the tortfeasor been insured.
I'm reading from then-Justice Carrigan's opinion for the Supreme Court in Newton versus Nationwide, where he says, the reduction of uninsured motorist coverage by PIP amounts paid or payable actually penalizes those who are more seriously injured, for as the PIP benefits increase, the amounts recoverable under the uninsured motorist coverage decrease. Now, am I to understand you're saying that's not the case with the underinsured motorist benefits here?
And
if it's not the same, why isn't it the same?
It is not the same because the benefits available did not change. They weren't reduced because the plaintiffs received everything they were entitled to receive.
But if they were close to the ceiling for underinsured motorists, wouldn't that in fact have been the case?
Had this, by close to it, you mean that the amount of the award was more than the close to it, I don't think that makes a difference. If, in fact, it takes money out of the insured's pocket, we have a different horse race. The insured is not seeking to recover that money here. They're seeking to recover it again. And that's what we contest, and that's what we think the policy prevents. I don't know if I answered your question, Judge.
No, I'm struggling with this because as the way I read then Justice Carrigan's opinion in Newton, if we had a different situation here where these ladies had much more significant injuries and they were at or near the ceiling for underinsured motorist coverage, and then these monies were deducted for the medical pay, then it would take money out of their pockets, just as Justice yes. Carrigan said it would in Nationwide. So I'm trying to figure out, just because the result is a little different because of the circumstances, why aren't we bound by Newton's analysis here?
Well, it's because that's a formulation of what is called the make-whole doctrine. Until the insured is made whole, the insurance carrier can't take such a deduction. And I think it would apply in that case. But I don't think it applies in this case because that hasn't happened. This situation, had the plaintiffs, I'm sorry, I've been up here for a long time. Last time I was here, you had a building.
we remember that too. And we will again.
Had the tortfeasor been insured for $100,000 and the claims had been made against him, had the plaintiffs, the appellants, recovered the same number against the tortfeasor, that would have been required to reimburse the medical pay. Now, and they still would have got the same amount of money. That's not the case here. The tortfeasor didn't have insurance, and but the medical bills were paid anyway. I don't think I stated that very clearly. I thought I did in my brief, but this is different than Nationwide because this deduction or this action doesn't damage the insureds. They are still receiving the full amount. I think the full amount received was 60 in cash. $60,000+, and the other one was $50,000+. When you add up what they were paid by the tortfeasor and the amount of money that American Family paid them immediately after the arbitration, they received $60,000+ and had their medical bills paid. Now, this is not a case where the insurance company is putting anything into its pocket. They haven't saved a nickel except for this double payment. So the bugaboo about the insurance company making money off something like that, well, they haven't.
As I understand what you're saying is that in this case, the benefits were paid. The benefits were paid to the medical providers.
Yes.
And what the insurance company wants to do is it wants to avoid having to pay those twice.
Yes.
Whereas in Newton, the benefits were such that the insurance company was actually reducing benefits to the insured.
As yes, sir. As I recall Newton, they were trying to take the, you recall No Fault, they were trying to take the benefits paid under No Fault and reduce the amount of UM coverage by those benefits. And I think that's what they were trying to do. I hope I'm not mistaken by that. And that does, that violates a number of things. It reduces the amount of coverage, which you can't do for a collateral source. And, you know, I think that's dated in, as far as this is concerned. American Family here is not trying to reduce the coverage, is not trying to take any money out of the insured's pockets. They just don't want to pay it again. On the interest question, it is, we just have case law. Says you can't do that. Judge, you can't modify it that way. We had no agreement for that. The interest came up after the award. I don't recall it being mentioned. Mr. Chernushin, in one of his briefs, said that he did request it, or did, and I don't remember whether it was the Levy brief or the Robertson brief. But in either event, it's like it used to be pleading. You either ask for it or you don't. And the damages were fixed by the arbitrators, and I think they were properly amended, and the judgment was paid, or the award was paid. And you asked Judge Graham whether the arbitration was for all matters, and it wasn't. We specifically agreed to reserve this question about the medical pay and policy limits. And we had no discussion about interest until after the award was entered. I always think of myself as a terse person, but I've been talking for 19 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
One point of clarification with regard to the amended complaint filed in district court. There is count one, which, I'm sorry, count two, wherein it recites that either party may demand arbitration, and plaintiff demanded arbitration to resolve the amount of payment due under Part 3 uninsured motorist coverage, and then went on to state, wherefore plaintiff prays for judgment against American Family for damages, pre-interest, judgment, costs, and such relief as she may be entitled under law and equity. So I think that supports our position that the matter of damages was that which was submitted to the arbitration panel with the question of interest and costs reserved for the court.
respond then to your counterpart's assertion that, as I understood him to say, if you asked for the prejudgment interest and then it was denied, and if you didn't ask for it, then you should have, basically.
That's true, but I have no recollection of us presenting any evidence or argument to the arbitration panel about prejudgment interest, because it was my belief that they were only to decide those classic elements of judgment set out in the jury instruction 6.1, medical bills, economic loss, pain and suffering, and permanent impairment. And I think that that position is supported by the fact as soon as the arbitration award was submitted, we then submitted our bill of costs. We did submit our motion for interest, which in Judge Gilbert's case and Levy case, he did grant the costs and interest. And then, of course, in Judge Schwartz, the Richardson Googe denied it. So that's our position, Your Honor, that it was reserved for the court. And lastly, when we address the issues raised in Newton, I think there is a dilution of what could be recovered, because in the Googe Richardson case, there was an award of $90,171.77. Under the law at the time of this crash, the $23,000 in change that was received from tortfeasor is deducted for a net of $67,000, and then you take away the $25,000, there's a substantial reduction in what Ms. Richardson could recover. And further, the question is, 10.4609 said those damages which can be claimed against the tortfeasor. And with that language, the uninsured motorist carrier stands in the shoes of the tortfeasor, and I don't believe can avail itself of any, cannot make arguments that the tortfeasor couldn't make. And that is in the case of the collateral source exception. The tortfeasor doesn't get the benefit of the prudence of the individual buying their MedPay insurance. And since there's inadequate amount of insurance under the tortfeasor's limit, and our client turns to the underinsured motorist carrier asking for those damages she could claim against the tortfeasor, she's got to be in the same position, and I don't believe it is permissible to allow that set off for the MedPay. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.